All right, I call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order at 4:04 p.m. on Monday, April 5th, 2021. Members present are Representatives Kaufman, Vice Chair Schragi, Representative McCarty, Representative Snyder, and myself, Representative Sponholz. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct the business. Thank you today to our Secretary Leah Fraser and our LIO moderator Nate Williams for joining us this afternoon. And I'll remind members to announce yourself for speaking for those online so that they can hear you, and make sure you speak clearly into your microphone. It makes it a lot easier for those that are participating online to hear you. We have four items of business today. The first up is we're going to have a second hearing and take final action on HB 30 relating to workers' compensation benefits. Second is an introductory hearing on HB 149 related to collective bargaining for child care workers. Third is an introductory hearing for HB 110 relating to e-cigarettes. And then lastly, roll forward the appointees we heard from our last meeting on Friday a.m. for consideration in a joint session. Are there any questions from members of the committee before we proceed? All right. So that brings us up then to HB 310. We have available for questions, we have Charles Collins, Director of the Division of Workers' Compensation with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, Marie Marks with Legislative Legal. And I think first we were going to ask Director Collins, since we have you online, to provide a brief overview of workers' compensation in Alaska, including rates and costs over time. You there?
Good afternoon. This is Charles Collins, the chair. And, so workers' compensation in Alaska is, as you have seen in your packet, I updated some work that we had done. And that, you know, the first thing I'd like to say is congratulations to all of you and to the Board of Alaska Workers' Compensation for being able to hold the cost of premiums down, and this will be the, as I stated one meeting before, the eighth year in a row that we've been able to reduce premiums to employers. Now, that comes with a little caveat, because there are some things in workers' compensation that haven't been adjusted for many years, and as Representative Josephson has pointed out in his bill, it's been quite some time since we've looked at some benefits for injured workers. Workers' compensation is the only path that an injured worker has. It's an exclusive way of being repaired if you're injured on the job. And it works well for the state of Alaska. It's not perfect. I won't tell you that it is, but I think that our employers and our employees have worked extremely hard to make it work. Over the years, since 1959, when the act was actually first started, we've had a number of updates. The last major update was actually in 2005. I think your board has done a great job of adjusting regulations as much as they can. There are some things in statute that cannot be changed, and that is why Representative Josephson has introduced this bill today. As far as the process, I put a little chart flow in there. So most of the things about workers' compensation, you get hurt on the job, you go see the doctor first, you tell your employer. It's a pretty straightforward thing. And under the, in the state of Alaska, you have 3 days to inform the division if there is an on-the-job site injury, and that's done multiple ways. Most of the time we get a report of injury directly from the employer, but now and again they won't be as timely as maybe the medical provider or something, but almost exclusively we get a report of injury from the employer, and then if everything goes good, the employee that's injured gets patched up, fixed, rehabilitated, sent back to the same job, hopefully, you know, in a fashion where they can return to work. You know, 90%+ of our injuries are meet that. We do have a few where there's some medical disputes, and the statutes are laid out for that to happen, where if an employer feels like there's a different path to rehabilitation than the employee, and that's what your board is for and your hearing officers, and they hear those cases. And we don't have many of those, you know, a small percentage of those a year, you know, 600 or 700 a year compared to 17,000 claims. I think that we're pretty effective at that. Almost all of those are settled in the best fashion possible between the employee and the employer based on medical expertise. And there is a team of lawyers out there that, you know, that work for the employers and bring their expertise to the table. And there's also a good cadre of employee representatives out there. And the nice thing about Alaska workers' compensation law is the employee is only held to having to pay for the first $300 consultation. And after that, if he prevails, his legal counsel gets paid through the act and by the employer, and the employee does not have to burden that cost. And that's why it's an exclusive liability work with workers' compensation. If you have any questions, need any help, want to know any numbers, don't hesitate to ask. Be glad to help you. It's always an honor to assist. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for that that update, Director Collins. Are there any questions for the director? All right. Looks like there are no questions for you today. So I'm going to go ahead and open up HB 30 for public testimony. Is there anybody online for public testimony?
No.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. Representative Kaufman?
I have a question for Director Collins.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Through the chair. Director Collins, I was looking at the sectional analysis, and Section 2 says that we went from 177,000, which was the 2,000 amount, to 273 to account for inflation. And then it says to bring Alaska up to the national average. Were we at the national average, to your knowledge, when we were at the 2,000, year 2000 amount?
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, in 2000, when the legislature settled on 177, they were just they would have been at more the median than the average, so just about in the middle of the state in the year 2000. It was quite a bit. In 2000, they went from 135,000 for the whole, for that starting number for the whole body, up to 177. If you read through the notes on the journal there, they argued about it a lot because they started at a little higher number, which would have been the average number, and came down about 25,000 off the top of my head. It's somewhere in that number to 177, and that was the negotiated agreement. That was more of a median number then. Unfortunately, you know, inflation has hung around with us for quite some time, and so to get back to, you know, kind of the middle of the road, middle of the pack, we would have to get up to a number somewhere close to what Representative Josephson has put forward.
Follow up.
Thank you. Through the chair. I'm still trying to get my arms wrapped around all of this. I've spent some time looking at the 2019 Workers' Compensation Research Institute numbers, and it's not easy. There's a lot of apples and oranges to look at with respect to how some of these things are tabulated, the many footnotes. And I'll just say from here, it looks quite complicated. I've got, what, 4 pages of tables, and within that, there's 2 pages of footnotes. So complicated issue. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, I completely understand. That's why we have a lot of experts here. But on the point of permanent partial impairment, it takes a doctor's rating for a whole body impairment, and then uses that baseline, which currently is 177,000. So without the AMA guide from the doctors, you can't start anywhere. Now, some states, like our sister state to the south, Washington, they break it out by body part and have a different compensation style, or maybe I should say quotient there. So, if you were damaged where you lost the use of an arm or something, it has a standard amount. And Alaska has chosen instead to have a whole body impairment. So if you go to the doctor and he gives you a certain percentage of whole body impairment, it makes it kind of complicated, and we rely on the doctors to come up with that number following the guides, and we update the guides as they get updated and start with that base amount. And so by medical profession, that AMA guide gets updated periodically, every couple of 3 years. In fact, they're working on one right now. But the baseline in Alaska has not moved for 21 years, so there we are.
Thank you.
All right. It looks like that is. Are there any other questions for Scott Jordan or Marie Marks with Ledge Legal? All right. Representative Josephson, did you have anything you wanted to add before we take action?
Chair Smith, not actually.
All right.
Thank you.
With that, do we have a motion?
Thanks, Madam Co-Chair. I move House Bill 30, version 32-LS0238, /A from committee with recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Is there any objection? All right. Seeing no objection, HB 30 passes from committee. We're going to take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. All right, we're back on the record, and I want to just let the record reflect that Co-Chair Fields was here at 4:14 p.m. So with that, our next item up on the bill is on our agenda today is HB 149 relating to collective bargaining for child care workers. Co-Chair Fields.
Thanks, Co-Chair Sponholz. I do appreciate the committee moving an earlier piece of legislation on child care tax credit, and given the devastating impacts of COVID on female participation in the workforce, which exacerbated a lot of underlying problems, inadequate supply of childcare, the gender pay gap, I thought it was worth this committee putting some thought into what are additional things we can do to address the gender pay gap, female participation in the workforce in general, and just the devastation on the childcare industry in particular that's been caused by the pandemic. And that was the origin of House Bill 149. So just stepping back a little bit to the problem, and my family has certainly lived this, persistently low wages and benefits in the childcare industry have resulted in high turnover and an inadequate supply of childcare workers and of childcare for working families. These are my two daughters, Zara and Simone, and I don't know if anyone tried teleworking with children during the pandemic, but you can see Simone is sitting in Zara's lap. It's really hard for Zara getting work done without childcare. Why does it matter? Obviously, it matters for individual families, but I think from an economic development perspective, you know, we've talked a lot about out-migration, and Alaska is losing families with folks over the age of 30. Significant contributor to our declining population. We need to be attracting those folks. The business community has recognized this for a long time, which is why AEDC has been focusing on making Anchorage the number one city to live, work, and play. Really hard to work without childcare. And, you know, the thing is, everywhere faces childcare problems. As a small state, I think we can actually solve them. And to the extent that we do that, we make ourselves so much more attractive to working-age professionals who are contributing a lot to our community. So from an economic development perspective, we should be doing this, even if we, you know, even if childcare per se is not our number one priority, economic development should compel us to examine this issue. And then secondarily, there, you know, over the last 50 years, we've just seen a growing body of data around very high return on investment for investing in early child learning. You know, certainly this wasn't the paradigm back when Universal High School came to America, back when we had the GI Bill of Rights. But this is the reality, and our institutions have not caught up with that data. So what can we do? It's worth noting 11 other states have established collective bargaining structures for home-based childcare providers to bargain with the state to establish livable wages and benefits in a manner that expands the supply of high-quality early childhood. First state was Illinois in 2005, and invited testimony we're going to hear from some folks in California, which was the most recent state to use this model. It's not the only model out there. There are civilized countries that directly subsidize child care centers and directly subsidize child care. We don't see that model quite as much in America. I think it's, you know, in terms of fiscal impacts, the European model would probably be a harder one for Alaska. So House Bill 49 follows this model that 11 other states have followed. And I want to be really clear, you know, maybe there are other ideas out there, and I want this bill, you know, potentially be a vehicle to improve child care, but also to spark conversation among us and other members on what we can do to solve this problem. What are some other mechanisms we could consider to raise wages? You know, it's really interesting. The fact that folks in the construction industry have middle-class jobs is 100% arbitrary in terms of a policy decision. We made a policy decision at the federal and state level that we're going to have prevailing wages in construction. Maybe we should do that for childcare. That's not what this bill does, but I'm very interested in hearing feedback from committee members. How else can we expand the supply of childcare to be adequate? And like I said, the European model is to directly subsidize childcare, and maybe we should contemplate that. But whatever we do, we have to do something to fix the inadequate supply of early childhood care and learning in our state. So why now? The federal administration is engaging in an unprecedented push to expand early child care and learning. This is kind of like the apprenticeship discussion, where we wanted to put the right policy framework in place to capitalize on federal investments. Now is the time if we're going to be looking at state policy structures for child care. And as I mentioned earlier, the pandemic decimated female participation in the workforce, put many child care providers out of business. We need rapid action now to help scale back up child care capacity in Alaska, because if we don't have that, how are working families going to get back to work in the manner that they want to get back to work? So with that, that is House Bill 149. We are going to have some invited testimony that talks about the details. How do you collectively bargain with a bunch of home-based child centers? I guess the one additional bill detail I would reference is, you know, when you think about collective bargaining, people tend to think you've got an employer and you've got employees. House Bill 149 is really interesting, and these other states' model is really interesting, because you're actually collectively bargaining with small businesses. Home-based child care providers are still the ones who actually decide whether or not to collectively bargain. So it is a little bit of a wrinkle in terms of our traditional employee employer relationship, but I think it is a good model in terms of raising standards in an entire sector. So happy to answer any questions. Also happy to take questions after the invited testimony if that might make more sense in terms of understanding the logistics of how this bill would work.
I think we should go to our invited testimony first, and then we can do a sectional. That's right. All right. All right. So next up, we're going to go to Kimberly Rosenberger with SEIU. Are you there, Ms. Rosenberger?
Yes. Thank you so much for having me. So I am here on behalf of SEIU California, but our child care provider union is called CCPU, which is a combination of SEIU and United Domestic Workers. Through the chair, I'm going to present on AB 378. That's the assembly bill that passed in 2019 to authorize child care providers to collectively bargain. Moving to the next slide, this was a bill that took about 16 years to get through. We became the most recent state to, as mentioned, and the way we did that was through a bifurcation of legislation and budget that allowed us to put language into the budget with funding to begin efforts to organize with state entities to create a master list of all the providers, and that went into effect immediately while we were able to negotiate the details through our legislation, which takes January 1st, 2020 was when it went into effect. The bill allowed us to have an election to choose a union, collectively bargain, and for a training partnership with the state. The reason this was necessary is because child care providers, as mentioned, are considered small businesses. Therefore, they're not covered by a number of wage and hour laws or labor laws. The biggest impact and reason we had to overcome that was actually the end of the 19th century, the Anti-Sherman Act applied to it and prevented collective bargaining because it was considered a monopoly. We were also, child care providers were excluded from the Taft-Hartley Act because child care services is always considered a low-wage worker, and they were not one of the services raised up, similar to farm workers and home supportive services. So what we had to do was get an antitrust exemption in which the state can, through either executive order or legislation, determine that the benefit of collective bargaining outweighs the risk of anti-competition. So our providers do remain, and on the next slide, we kind of lay out what we do, but they do remain still considered small businesses. It only applies to family care providers, exempt and license exempt, such as family and friends. It doesn't apply to centers or assistants because they are already covered under existing wage law. That was laid out in addition to things such as rates, benefit trust fund, training, and provider retention and recruitment because similar to Alaska and California, we are facing a significant workforce shortage. Our members are an aging population, and we need to recruit new young providers. It also included a stipulation similar to other public employees where we negotiate at the bargaining table with the state and governor, and then it has to be ratified through the legislature, and that's done through a trailer bill at the conclusion of negotiations. The next slide, for the process for representation, child care providers are a little unique. Traditionally, you need 50%, but we put provider interest at 10% because there's a language barrier. They're difficult to access. In large part due to the license exempt, we have providers that fall in and out of service. So we did a lower threshold, but despite that, we still received about 25% of the unit voting during a pandemic when we weren't able to do a door-to-door campaign. And of that, 97% ratified the union. So there's a clear need and desire. We also included a list of eligible voters where we looked at the retroactive activity, how long they would have to be in service before they could participate, and other details like that in order for the state entities to make things workable. The training partnership is essential to the legislation because we have new mandates, our members want to provide quality service, and they can't keep up a lot of times with the training that they're required to do while still being open. This allowed for us to find professional development, it allowed for professional development, for training, and for funding dollars so that we could provide the greatest access to our members. I think we're two slides over now. Sorry, I skipped through training partnership, but I'm happy to go into detail again on that if needed. As I mentioned, we are the newest state to join in allowing childcare workers to unionized, so we are currently at the bargaining table, but in other states we have seen that child care providers receive higher rates, we have seen additional funding for dollars, and we have seen a growth in slots for 0 to 3, which are crucial to getting women back in the workforce after having children, and opening more non-traditional hours. while we do not at this time have a contract but are in the process, we already have seen the benefit of having a union during this pandemic because we were able in real time to respond to the needs of not just our workers but families in order to stay open and provide service for essential care workers as they continue to, you know, go into work during the pandemic and through the changing tiers. That concludes my presentation, but I'm available for any questions or additional feedback.
All right. Are there questions for Ms. Rosenberger? Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm curious, what are the other 11 states?
I have a slide. Just give me 1 second to pull it up, and I can read them off for you. And I apologize for the delay. If I may get back to you on that, and I can share, we have a document breakdown of each of the states actually, and the similar structures they've passed.
I think I can actually read them off through the chair. Mm-hmm. So, at least a partial list, Illinois, Washington, Oregon, Iowa, New Jersey, Michigan, and Wisconsin were some of the first ones. And then that was as of 2007. Since 2007, New York, Pennsylvania, Kansas, Maryland, Ohio, Maine, and New Mexico.
Thank you.
I'm happy to share this.
I would like to see that. Thank you.
All right. Are there other questions for Ms. Rosenberger? Any other questions for Co-Chair Fields? All right, can we do a quick sectional? Oh, sorry, Representative Kaufman.
I guess. So there is a cost impact of organizing. And so how is through organizing, the cost will go up. How does that improve accessibility?
Yeah, I think two questions, kind of cost of the organizational process from the state perspective. So this would be one multi-employer election overseen by the Alaska Labor Relations Agency, ALRA. And have they provided a fiscal note, Tristan, yet?
Yes.
Okay. So the fiscal note has ALRA's estimated case for one election. Obviously, one election, not super expensive. And then in terms of accessibility, I might actually go back to Ms. Rosenberg's slide on benefits. So, you know, if you're a small business in Alaska, it is extremely difficult to find high-quality, affordable health insurance. If you are able to access a trust, you're going to have much lower rates. So one benefit is just in terms of scale, accessing those benefits. This childcare model actually grew out of a model that workers in Illinois had established for home care. And I think when you look at home care, you have some of the same problems we see in childcare. High turnover, low wages, and so on. And certainly both in child care and home care, it is clear that when you have an established training structure, that does improve quality and you have less turnover, which is a more efficient system. So I think that's been demonstrated through the experience in multiple states. The interesting thing I think about the market in Anchorage is, you know, my family would, we would happily pay more for child care. You actually can't. It's not available in the market, and that's because we're essentially in a low-wage, high-turnover trap where, you know, this industry doesn't pay living wages. I think as Ms. Rosenberg referenced, some of that is historical. Professions that we're seeing as being done by people of color were excluded from some of our foundational labor relations laws because of the composition of Congress at the time, where basically Democrats in the South didn't want to give collective bargaining rights to people whose skin was dark. I mean, that's just a reality. Farm workers and domestic workers were excluded. So really,
women.
And women. So starting with that, you had this kind of division into industries that are going to pay a living wage and those that aren't. And we suffer from that today.
If I may, through the chair, one of the benefits we've seen is that we have, especially in licensed exempt, when we provide training, those are family and friends that come into child care doing it out of a favor and just receiving that small subsidy that really wasn't the reason they got into it, but because they enjoy the work and they're able to grow their job and have flexible hours, we see them staying in the field. And the only way we can keep them in the field is through training and through livable wages. And we, for a while, when we saw rate reform happen, did see a growth. And then once rate reform stagnated, we started to see a drop off in new additions. So we do believe that you get the best return on your dollars invested by growing the workforce and retaining workers that have entered.
Representative Snyder.
I think following a little bit the line of questions coming from Representative Kaufman, I'm thinking back of utilizing in-home child care myself with my two young boys when they were little, and we did locate someone through Thread. And I'm curious, I'm thinking what her reaction might be to this and how I might respond to that, as she's a small in-home daycare provider. How might this affect someone in her shoes running a business?
Thanks to the chair. In short, she has it's her choice of whether or not to unionize, and I'm going to turn to Ms. Rosenberg for kind of testimony on what they heard from providers. And again, this is really unique because we're talking about small businesses that are effectively collectively bargaining. You know, your larger child care centers are going to continue to be governed under the National Labor Relations Act. Their employees can unionize that facility if they want. But this is about those in-home providers and giving them a mechanism to make it a more sustainable business model and supply the amount of child care that working professionals need.
Ms. Rosenberger.
Thank you. Through the chair, I would say that we had an overwhelming response and support from our child care providers, but again, they are able to opt in, so they're not required to participate in the union or pay dues unless they want to. And as I mentioned, in California, it only applies to those that receive subsidies. However, we have a number of child care providers that have chosen to join the union simply because of the training mechanism. A lot of them need that training. It can often be mandated by the state, but they don't know where to access it or how. So they just see this as another tool in their belt to receive information on what's happening in the state, update on regulations, and receive training. It also provides a way for them to advocate and find a voice for things. So we get real-time feedback on how new regulations or need for regulations are being needed by both the providers and the family members. So as I mentioned, we had a large showing in our vote with a 97% approval rate. So it is something that I think most providers are calling out for.
All right, let's do a sectional.
For the record, to the chair, representatives, for the record, Tristan Walsh, staff to Representative Fields. This is the sectional analysis for HB 149 version A. This is a 23-section bill, and it can seem really long, but essentially it's following what Ms. Rosenberger stated, is that other states, they've codified this through executive orders or through statute. And so in this case, it is through a legislative amendment to the Public Employees Employment Relations Act. So Section 1. This section amends AS 2340-070, the Declaration of Policy regarding the Public Employment Relations Act, to include child daycare providers. Section 2. This section amends AS 2340-080 to give child daycare providers the right to self-organize, join or assist an organization to bargain collectively, and engage in concerted activities for the purposes of collective bargaining or other mutual aid or protection. Section 3. This section amends AS 2340-090 to include child daycare providers in the definition of a collective bargaining unit. Section 4. This section amends AS 2340-100A to include child daycare providers in the statute regarding the election of representatives and organizations for collective bargaining. Section 5. This section amends AS 2340-100B to add child daycare providers to the statute that directs the Labor Relations Agency to officiate the election on representation following the determination that a question of representation exists. Section 6. This section amends AS 2340-110A to add child daycare providers to the statute of prohibiting unfair labor practices by the public employer or agent of the public employer. Section 7. This section makes conforming changes in AS 2340-205 regarding public employee family leave benefits. Section 8. This section amends AS 2340-210-D to make conforming changes. Section 9. This section amends AS 2340-225 to add child daycare providers. It clarifies that child daycare providers have the right of non-association. Section 10. This section adds a new section to AS 2340 to add language that nothing in this bill makes child daycare providers and organizations public employees, and their inclusion in this bill does not form or terminate employer or employee relationships, change a child care provider's legal status as an entity, corporation, or sole proprietorship. It declares nothing in the bill is intended to interfere with compliance by a person, the state, or political subdivision of the state with a federal law or requirement of a federal grant or subsidy. It also states that nothing in this bill prohibits a child daycare provider from communicating with a public employer or another person. It also states that a child daycare provider organization may not process or administer payments for daycare. Section 11 through 23 are conforming changes in definitions. And so if you'd like, I can continue, but it's also just going to be literally as stated.
No. I am a little bit confused about the statute being updated as referencing a public employer or an agent of a public employee, and yet we're not making child care providers public employee, the child care providers public employees.
Through the chair, that's correct. They are not becoming public employees. All you're doing is giving them a mechanism to bargain in their sector.
All right. It's an interesting section of law to put the bill in, is, I guess, maybe my observation.
It goes back to that historic exclusion from the NLRA.
Okay.
If I may, through the chair, the reason we found it so important is because they want to retain their identity as a small business, but they are still dealing with the state regardless because of subsidies and rates that are provided. So there is already the interaction between the states and these small businesses. We're just now allowing them to collectively negotiate those that existing relationship, but it doesn't change the employee relationship. They are still small businesses. They are just now able to, as one voice, say that we believe we need more slots for 0 to 3, or this rate is reflective of what we think the regional rate is.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We also have Dan Wayne from Ledge Legal online, and I guess I want to ask Dan Wayne the same question about the selection of this particular area of law for this provision. Do you want me to restate the question?
Yes, Madam Chair. This is Dan Wayne from Ledge Legal. I'm on the phone.
All right.
To answer your question.
Thanks. I guess this section of law is really largely referencing public employees or agents of public employees. You want to sort of describe why it is that you chose this section of law to amend rather than create a new section of law?
Well, as the sponsor stated, it's an approach that was used in California, and in some of the other 11 states, I think, have used a similar approach. Basically, broadened the mission of the state labor relations agency to include oversight of labor issues for child daycare providers, because if we were talking about some other kind of workers, people who work in private transportation, for example, we might be preempted as a state from doing much as far as regulating labor in that sector, because they're covered by the National Labor Relations Act. But these folks aren't.
All right, thank you. That was very helpful.
There's one more thing I need to add to that, Madam Chair. If you're a single provider of home care With whom are you going to unionize? How are you going to access a trust? There's actually no way to do that, which is why it's important to empower small businesses in the industry to work together.
Mm-hmm. All right. Representative McCarty?
Yes, through the chair. So I have a question about this. Is it Dan that's online?
Mr. Wayne.
Mr. Wayne.
Yep,
okay.
Wayne.
Mr. Wayne, through the chair. So this is stating that they're recognized as an entity of the state, yet they're not really connected to the state, but at the same time that they're subsidized by the state for the recognition with the state. Is this what I'm hearing?
Well, Representative McCarty, through the chair, this is Dan Wayne from Ledge Legal. I'm not sure that that's a fully accurate description of what the bill does. I don't think that the state would be subsidizing anyone, for example. It just puts the Alaska Labor Relations Agency in charge of regulating labor disputes and labor action between child care providers and public employers.
To answer your question?
No.
All right,
can I follow up?
I think Representative Fields also has something to add.
Well, I was just going to say through the chair, Representative McCarty, this is basically an approach to what's called sectoral bargaining, where you try to raise standards in a sector of industry. Because the U.S. has what I would call fairly outdated approaches to labor relations, where it's bargaining based on a firm, and then you throw in this racist history that excluded domestic and farm workers and female-centered occupations. You have basically kind of a fractured landscape in terms of bargaining. This bill is a narrowly tailored approach to bring a sectoral bargaining framework to one sector that was historically excluded from federal labor law. And that's why, I guess you could say, it's pigeonholed in bargaining with the state. But it's, I think if you look at it from the perspective of we're providing a framework for sectoral bargaining with many small businesses, that's how you can kind of understand it when it's neither a public employer per se, but is negotiating with the state.
And before we go much further, I'm just going to point out, this is an introductory hearing. We're not moving this bill this week. So folks don't need to be worried that we're pushing this through. We'll have more opportunity to take this up in the future, but we're not moving it anytime soon. I do want to make sure that we get to Representative Hannon's bill as well. We have an introductory hearing for her, and there are a bunch of us that need to leave at 5:10 for a 5:15 meeting. So I just want to call that out. Do you have one more question, Representative McCarty?
Just the question for the record, if we could continue on later,
yeah.
Is that separating the component of some quandary of association to the state and stuff like that, but I'm hearing from Ms. Rosenberg that the California model and these other 11, that the state is subsidizing the programs. As we have these for-profit industries, childcare, but it's being subsidized. So that's the question. If we want to address that next time, that's the
question. And I can briefly answer, Madam Chair. We already provide subsidies based on income eligibility to certain families, and that would continue, and this bill doesn't alter that. If ultimately the federal government subsidizes childcare in a more meaningful way, I think a bill like this could position us to capitalize on it. And I guess in closing, so we can move on, I would just say I appreciate everyone listening. I realize y'all probably haven't seen this idea before. I wanted to put it on the table, and maybe there's support for this idea, or maybe there's a support for another idea to improve wages and working conditions and the supply of childcare. But I think this committee needs to deal with it. The pandemic has really heightened the need. So thanks again.
All right. Thank you for bringing a conversation starter forward. It's definitely an interesting topic. All right. Next up, we're going to go to HB 110 by Representative Hannon, electronic smoking products excise tax.
Thank you, co-chairs Sponholz and Fields. I'm Representative Sarah Hannon, representing House District 33, which you're sitting in. I have my staff with me today, Stephanie Andrew. House Bill 110 is a bill that does two things primarily. It changes the state law regarding tobacco and tobacco products to conform with a change in federal law, moving the consumption and sell age from 19 to 21. A year ago, the federal government changed it to 21. It also puts an excise tax onto electronic cigarettes, more commonly known as vaping. A strange twist in the Alaska statutes on tobacco taxes is we tax tobacco by type. So chewing tobacco, cigarettes, cigars, now they all have the same tax, but they are listed by type. And the last time that tobacco taxes were touched, about 12 years ago, vaping didn't really exist, so it wasn't included in those reforms. So currently, there are no state of Alaska taxes on electronic nicotine-related products. When cannabis came in as an industry, vaping was a thing, and vaped or electronic cigarette cannabis is taxed at the same rate as all other cannabis. So the last cycle of the legislature, there were two bills to do this one thing. There was one dealing with age-conforming changes and one to do the excise tax. There is a companion bill on the Senate side. The senator who's behind that bill, over the interim, we had lots of discussions about commingling. But it makes what's actually a pretty small bill in change, in changes, have a lot of pages because the age in statute, the age change appears in a number of places in the statutes. Because as it turns out, if you don't know this, tobacco, primarily cigarettes, is a very highly regulated product from grower to retailer across the nation. And so the federal government has always had a very strong hand in monitoring the production of tobacco products and where they're sold, where they're distributed, who's got access to them, and where the taxes are. E-cigarettes have created a bit of an anomaly or disruption in that because they don't always start with raw tobacco, which is tracked, and they don't typically all end up in the same hands and sellers. And as most people know, over the last decade, one of the niches that has developed is electronic cigarettes are very popular among young people who are under the age of 21 and under the age of 19 primarily. And in fact, between 2017 and 2018, the Center for Disease Control, that does a national tobacco survey every other year, saw a 78% increase in the use of e-cigarettes by high school students. We've seen a downturn in other traditional tobacco products, in smoking cigarettes, even in chew, but e-cigarettes, also known as vaping, has become sort of the niche for entree into the nicotine addiction. And I think most of us are old enough to now know, maybe Representative Shragi is young enough that he's always grown up with an anti-smoking message in his background, but there was a time where the idea of maybe it's not so bad for you, and really the research tells us nicotine is a very addictive substance, and if you can delay access to it, which typically young people are price sensitive, and I think that adding them into a tax structure, increasing the price on them, will discourage use and hopefully discourage a permanent lifelong addiction that will find its way into health risks. It is perceived by many young people that e-cigarettes is somehow not as risky as traditional cigarettes. And there is no research that supports that. And in fact, the research tells us your addiction might come on much quicker because the rate of absorption and ability to absorb it in electronic format that might have one container of e-cigarette might, one liquid unit might have as much nicotine in it as a package of cigarettes. So you don't perceive it as having smoked a whole lot because it's in this liquid form and it's easily ingestible. The goal is to discourage young people smoking, to get our state laws to conform with the now federal rules around 21-year-olds, and side benefit, it'll produce a little revenue. There are a couple other things specific to the sale of tobacco that the bill does, which is prohibit the products over the internet to be sold to you directly and individually. Buy it online and have it delivered to you, which seems to be one of the markets at which young people do it, and does require age verification of a purchaser who is legally purchasing online. So that would not be an internet sale, but you're buying from a tobacco shop in Anchorage and you live in Dillingham and you're having your chewing tobacco shipped out to you, that the third-party distributor, common carrier. The third-party common carrier does an age verification that they are delivering to someone who is age 21 in receipt of the tobacco product that they are legally entitled to have. And that's what the bill does.
All right. Thank you. And we have invited testimony. We've got a few folks to provide testimony. I think first up we're going to go to Emily Neenan with the American Cancer Society.
Good afternoon, Chair Sponholz. I'm getting a little bit of an echo. I'm going to mute myself and unmute again. Nope, it's fixed. Excellent. Chair Sponholz and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Emily Neenan. I'm the Alaska Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. I've been working on tobacco prevention policy in Alaska for a number of years. I will mention that I work in close partnership with the American Heart Association and the American Lung Association in Alaska. On behalf of our organizations, we're happy to continue to be a resource on tobacco prevention and cessation issues throughout this bill and anything else that may come up. I'm glad to be here today discussing this update to our state's tobacco statutes. Increasing the price is a critical piece to the three pieces that we know are most successful at reducing youth tobacco use. That is having a comprehensive prevention program, such as what the health department is administering now. Having smoke-free workplaces, which I'm proud to say we do have in our state, smoke-free indoor workplaces, and then increasing that price is the big piece that has a huge impact on preventing youth from ever starting. Anybody who's ever been around anybody even that's used tobacco knows how hard it is to quit. If we can keep kids from ever starting, we prevent that lifelong addiction and disease. And that's the big reason behind this effort. Early in my career, I worked on the 2004 tobacco tax increase here in Alaska. Our tax statute hasn't changed since 2004, but the market has. E-cigarettes entered the U.S. market between 2006-2007 and really took off just in the last few years. We've seen this explosion in youth e-cigarette use. Particularly with the latest generation of products, by the time you combine the flavors and marketing with some of the technological innovations, I'll say, using nicotine salts that kind of ease the throat hit of e-cigarettes and just make them easier for kids to use, and put them at greater risk of the ongoing addiction. We do share the concerns about the health effects. You'll hear more about that from the State Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. They have a lot of research, good information on that. A question often comes up, however, how do these products, electronic cigarettes, compare with the health harms of regular cigarettes. And as you're thinking about that, I will ask you to consider this. The combusted cigarette has over 3,000 chemical compounds, and 69 or 70 of those are known human carcinogens, known cancer-causing agents. It's not actually difficult to be less harmful than the combusted cigarette. So something to keep in mind. One other thing I will just mention as you're reviewing this update to our tobacco statute, which has tax statute hasn't been updated since 2004, the health organizations do support removing those old penalties for youth possessing tobacco. We are in favor of helping young people get access to appropriate tobacco cessation services and working with school districts and making sure there are good options available rather than criminalizing youth for being addicted to a product that's been heavily marketed to them. I want to thank the bill sponsor and the staff and committee for your attention to this issue. And again, happy to continue to be a resource and answer any questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony today, Ms. Neenan. And I'll just note that I'm the co-chair now, and co-chair Fields here is also pleased to be hearing this bill today. All right. Are there any questions for Ms. Neenan? All right. Oh, Representative Kaufman.
Actually, to the chair, you mentioned that we have to cut this off. I'm just wondering, will we have another opportunity to ask more questions at a future hearing?
We will. In fact, it's my understanding that if we need to, we could come back after our caucus tonight to hear further on this bill, and we'll be able to pick up this topic at a future hearing. And I'm trying to remember when we're scheduled for next for this topic. Friday. So we'll be able to talk more on Friday as well.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Next up, we're going to go then to the Tobacco Prevention and Control Team. We've got Christy Knight and Katie Steffens.
Hi, this is Katie Steffens. Through the co-chairs, we were invited to be available for questioning today.
All right. I think that my notes might be you might be mislabeled. All right. We'll go to Joe Darnell then. That explains why Stephanie's looking at me like, please don't do that, Rep. Sponholz. All right. Mr. Darnell?
We may have lost Mr. Darnell.
All right. We don't have Mr. Darnell then. Well, that gives us a couple of moments for questions. Representative Kaufman?
All right. Well, thank you. I've received good arguments both ways. And just to play the devil's advocate, the concerns that increasing taxes will increase the black market, which these little modules that go on these devices are very portable, very compact relative to a pack of cigarettes. So. I'm concerned that there may be merit to that argument that if we up the taxes, that will, given the portability of these components, that will just really build the black market for this. Could we discuss that a bit?
Representative Hannah, would you like to take that, or would we like to ask Ms. Neenan?
Well, I will just start with sort of a semantical correction through the co-chair, which is, there is no tax, so we're not upping the tax. We are putting it into the tax structure. So the black market for e-cigarettes exists outside of state of Alaska governing it. Anyone who is currently under the age of 19 is already illegally purchasing and consuming. So I guess I would ask you to contemplate by putting it into our enforcement and taxation structure, whether we have a better control on the black market that already exists. Ms. Neenan from the American Cancer Society has probably a much lengthier description of that.
Ms. Neenan?
Through the co-chair Sponholz, Representative Kaufman. The black market issue is something that comes up frequently in conversation around any time you're increasing or changing, making changes to tobacco taxes. One thing to keep in mind is the buying patterns, how people buy their tobacco products. Generally, we know with regular cigarettes and other tobacco products, most users want to quit and buy their products one pack at a time at the whatever their corner store, grocery store, convenience store is. When it comes to e-cigarettes, this bill is, I would say, well-timed because it's following on the heels of some pretty major overhaul in federal law, crackdowns in the on the common carriers being able to ship these products. I know anecdotally from I have a friend who works in as a customs inspector inspecting. There's actually a lot of these products are made in China. Ironically for us, interestingly for us, a lot of them actually come through Anchorage as cargo. So they're being inspected along the way. There's a big a lot more focus on catching these things before they can enter the market than they used to be, and the additional restrictions around shipping will help with that as well.
You have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you. Yeah, through the chair, another thing that's brought up sometimes is that people say, well, I use this to quit cigarettes, which are, at least in their minds, considered more harmful. Do you feel there's any merit to that argument? Thank you.
Through the co-chair, Representative Kaufman, my advice to anyone listening is if you want to quit using a tobacco nicotine product, I would go with one of the FDA-approved tobacco cessation products that are out there because they get a tremendous amount of rigorous medical standards. No electronic cigarette no company has actually even applied to have their products treated as cessation products by the FDA. So if somebody has been able to quit and fully quit using these e-cigarettes, that's great, but they are not a cessation product. I would encourage, have to state as the American Cancer Society, Cancer Action Network, we do support efforts to quit and want to keep people safe in that, so I would recommend using an FDA-approved cessation product. The final thing I'll just add is the main concern that we have, though, and the thing that we've been discussing with Representative Hannon is the ability to keep kids from ever starting to use the products, and that's where we're going to see the biggest impact, is keeping kids from ever starting.
Co-Chair Fields?
Yeah, thanks. Through the chair, just wanted to add for Representative Kaufman. It's interesting because when these products came out, they were marketed as sort of, ooh, help you stop smoking. But I think, you know, that marketing device was belied by the companies marketing directly to kids who weren't addicted yet with, you know, certain colors, flavors, and so on. And that claim was also belied when Big Tobacco took over all these companies. So now Big Tobacco has both your traditional cigarettes, which are horrible for you, and electronic cigarettes, which are horrible for you. Mm-hmm. And they're both addiction machines, and they actually kind of feed off one another. So I think had that actually been true, number one, these companies would have applied to be smoking cessation devices. But number two, you wouldn't have seen Big Tobacco go all in with these aggressive marketing campaigns to kids.
Yeah. One of my brothers migrated to e-cigarettes a few years ago and has, after smoking traditional tobacco for a couple of decades, and continues about a decade later to use an e-cigarette, and is as hooked as he was before. He just smells different. So I don't think it solved the problem at all. Yeah. Representative Hannon.
And thank you, Co-Chair Sponholz. I will draw your attention to, it's on page 3 of the bill. It's in current statute. It's under Section 3, which starts on page 2, but at the top of page 3, tobacco cessation products that have been found by the U.S. FDA as tobacco cessation or harm reduction, so nicotine gum, patches, et cetera, are excluded from our tax structure. And so if a product had applied to the FDA and found that their formulation was deemed a cessation product, it would be excluded from our taxation statutes.
All right, and Representative McCarty has a question, and then I'm just going to note that we're going to set this bill aside for now. Representative McCarty.
A quick question through the chair, Representative Hannon. You said that the federal government's made the change of the age to 21, and where is that being implemented in other states?
Through the co-chair. It depends on your state. Because it's vastly different how each state that the U.S. federal government a year and a half ago changed it and said states need to comply. I believe we've got an info paper of how states have complied. But we may have to get back to you. I don't know that we included any where we are in compliance, although Ms. Emily may be able to monitor that because they are a national organization and they may be able to tell us how many states have changed their state statutes to comply with the feds.
Can you answer the question in 1 minute or less, Ms. Neenan? Or should we do a follow-up?
Absolutely. Just quickly through the co-chair, Representative McCarty, the Food and Drug Administration is in charge of implementation of tobacco age 21 across the nation, and then every state has its own laws, and this would bring our state up to update our state statutes so that we can do our own thing on top of what the feds are doing in compliance. We have a very successful compliance program with vendor education. We'd like to be able to do that work up to age 21 instead of just relying on the FDA, but the FDA is doing it now across the nation.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. So with that, we're going to just wrap up our introductory hearing for HB 110. I want to thank everybody for bringing the bill forward. I apologize that we're sort of pushing this a little bit faster this afternoon. We'll blame it on the air travel issues that came up this afternoon. We're going to hold this bill today. We're going to take it back up for final action on Friday, April 9th. Amendments will be due on Thursday, the 8th at 3:15 p.m. And then quickly before we go, the House Labor and Commerce Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the governor's appointees and recommends that the names be forwarded to a joint session. They are Jake Maxwell, ARPED, Bruce Magyar, Catherine Fritz for the State Board of Registration for Architects, Engineers, and Land Surveyors. That's a catchy name. Nathan Missler for the State Physical Therapy and Occupational Therapy Board. Christine Hansen, Bradley Heaston, Gregory Johnson to the Board of Dental Examiners. Pam Steffies, Michael Mavenkamp to the Board of Examiners and Optometry. Richard Clampett, Joy Collins, and Kayla Green to the Board of Marital and Family Therapy. Sammy O'Neill and Eleanor Vinson, Board of Professional Counselors. Bernard Gatewood and Bradley McConnell and Sherry Scott, Board of Psychologist and Psychological Associate Examiners. Brandon Erkenbrack to the Board of Social Work Examiners. Robert Pickett and Keith Kerber to the RCA, or Regulatory Commission of Alaska. This doesn't reflect any intent by members of the committee to vote for or against any of these individuals during a further session for purposes of confirmation. All right, and then just to make sure I'm not missing up any housekeeping. That wraps up our hearing today. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Our next one will be on Wednesday, April 7th at 3:15 in Barnes 124. We'll have an introductory hearing for HB 85 relating to the liability for financial institution, and we'll take up the remaining governor's appointees. We are almost done with confirmation hearings. Thanks again to Leah Frazier and Nate Williams for your support. And this meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee is adjourned at 5:13 p.m.
Thank you all for your attention.